I'd like to welcome everybody to our call tonight. It's my pleasure to have a guy I've known for 10 years. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, I think I trained with you and Kevin back in 95, actually.
Yeah, so a little bit longer
than
10 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. The first time, well, you took the first training at the Guild.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever that was. But anyway, it's been a long time, and he got into our field. He studied hypnosis ever since he got into it, obviously, and he continues to study and learn and network and break new ground. So, and I always use the NLP motto of find someone that knows how to do what you want and ask them about it rather than try to be the expert in everything. And Devin's become the expert in some of the health issues like diabetes and, of course, OCD that we'll be talking about tonight, and I'm sure we'll go into the other things that he's done. And he continues to expand on that and make the training so the hypnotist and NLPers and psychotherapists or social workers can help people with these medical problems, working with the medical community rather than against it, and how to network and do things like that. So we'll be going, asking a lot of questions, and we've Devin and I talked earlier, and of course we both like to take questions from the audience that we'll do in a little bit. So if people have questions, now's the time to ask it. And then, of course, we're recording it, and it'll probably be up on Devin's site in a day or two, and then my site also. And so that's, please feel free to refer people to that, because I know this is one of his passions, like mine is addictions and sports. It's easy to share your passions with other people because it makes them more passionate about it. So again, I'd like to welcome my friend Mr. Hastings.
Hey.
Hey. Well, I'd like to start with a question, and the first question always is, how did you get into this field?
How did I get into applying NLP and the hypnosis to anxiety? Oh,
in general, how did you get into the hypnosis, and then, so give us a little bit of background on yourself, how you got into the hypnosis and the NLP, and then what led you into what you're doing now. Oh, and I forgot to mention, he's now an international trainer. So,
oh, thank you. Yeah, I've traveled overseas a bit, and I also travel around the country and teaching on subjects that are of passionate interest to me. And, diabetes first became a specialty after I was diagnosed, and diabetes has also run through my family and stuff. But I got involved with hypnosis back in 1982 when I was in college, and I wrote a paper called Hypnotism and New Frontiers. And I thought, wow, and I still have it. And I thought, this is pretty cool. So I started using it, to help other people. I was experimenting because one of the things that Bandler and Grinder always, or Bandler especially, I guess, talked about was, wanton experimentation, where you just go out and, you try all of this stuff anywhere and everywhere you can. And so I used it, with people in college and stuff. I used it to help myself to the best of my ability at the time. So I've been involved in this field a long time and have had, a passionate curiosity about it, for a number of reasons. But I've always been a helper, wanted to do stuff, and I suppose that just comes from a family background and stuff like that. And just curious also how it could help me, as well. And so I've been doing it a long time and, just reading and listening to everything and anything that I can to learn how to better apply these tools of, personal change.
Great. Well, that's interesting because you have a little bit of the same background I did. When I first got back into hypnosis, of course, I first hypnotized somebody in high school, read a script. They actually went into trance, did what I asked. It scared me to death. But when I got back into it in the 80s, this was pre-internet, and there wasn't a lot of trainings out there. I know Jerry was doing trainings, I guess, back then. It was, he was doing them in Florida, obviously, in Gil Boyne. But, if you didn't know where to look, you had nowhere to go. So many of us started hypnotizing people, just like Devin said. I remember worked in a detox center. I just started hypnotizing people and then learned the NLP and things like that. So, and when were you first exposed to the NLP, as we say?
You were first exposed to NLP. You studied with Bandler?
I did, yes.
I think, yeah, yeah. So you're like first generation NLP. Like,
oh, yeah.
I'm reminded of martial arts. You know, you always studied the lineage of your teacher, as it were.
All right. And so you got into the hypnosis, and then you got into the NLP, and where is your practice at today, and what do you do with that? And then we'll talk about your trainings, and we'll get into the specifics.
Right now, we have a Minnesota State licensed school, and it's located in Minnetonka, Minnesota, and we teach a variety of certification trainings under the banner of NEFNELP. I certify people as basic and master practitioners and trainers and stuff like that. Is that the only way to do it? You know, because you were the teacher for me, and I prefer the lineage. You know, it's better. And I also teach like anxiety specialist certifications. I obviously specialize in the diabetes thing because back in 1989 or something, I was going blind from it. You know, literally could not look into a person's eyes 5 feet away because I couldn't see them. And after going into a massive depression, you know, it lasted several months. It was one of several major episodes of depression. You know, I started applying this stuff and got my vision back. I still have 20/20 vision today, and blood sugars are controlled and that sort of thing. And I've done a ton of research in this stuff, too. So it's something that, and I saw an area where it was wide open for, you know, exploration, as it were. And I got published in 1999 in what was then Diabetes Interview Magazine, which is now Diabetes Health Magazine. And if a person Googles hypnosis for diabetes, that particular article will pop up, usually on the first page. And, you know, I've studied transactional analysis, cognitive behavioral therapy, and I'm sure some people will recognize logotherapy, which was created by Viktor Frankl. He wrote Man's Search for Meaning. And I combine all of these things into my practice to help people. So, years and years and years of consuming information, always asking questions. I wonder if, or I wonder how. And then, I look at the modality and I figure out how I can apply it.
Okay. All right. And I know you do, like you say, you do trainings. And so, what was your first big personal breakthrough besides your personal thing? I always like to hear stories of client successes besides the personal ones. Tell us about some of the people you've worked with either the diabetes and the OCD.
Well, the diabetes, and this is a big subject. What happens with most people, roughly 90% of persons who are diagnosed with diabetes, they have a weight loss challenge or a weight gain challenge. You know, people always say, I have an eating problem, and I look at this huge person and I say, apparently not. because I obviously...
You know how to eat. So
yeah. It's a stop eating problem, actually. And by the way, weight loss does fall under the anxiety, obsessive kind of thing, where people do it obsessively because they have thoughts that drive them to do it. But clients that I've worked with, in regards to the diabetes, I talked to a woman maybe 2 years ago, and then I'll get back to the first time I did this, and I sent her a diabetes CD that I have, and she emailed me back a week later and said that her blood sugars were the lowest they'd been in 9 months. And there are a variety of reasons for why this can occur, and they're all scientific, because I work on documented evidence as to why things would work. But back in 92, when I was going blind from the diabetes and then decided to start applying it to people who had that problem, I had a client one time, and they came in, and their blood sugars were really high, and what happened is that their job was extremely stressful, and stress in and of itself will drive a person's blood sugars higher because it is a fight-or-flight response in the end. So I just said, well, why don't we just work on this and hypnotize them to have a better response to work and everything else. And then, you know, continued to work with them, and their blood sugars began to drop, and they stayed low so long as they were practicing these stress reduction techniques that any hypnotist or NLP-er can teach somebody. And that was probably, I want to say in 93 or something like that, you know, where I discovered, okay, you know, there's something more than this here. I mean, I already knew it because I applied it to myself, and I wanted to see if it would work with other people. And the article that I wrote for Diabetes Health, I just said, you know, the Wright brothers, I mean, they were the only people who believed in flight, and their first flight was only 11 feet. But that first flight ensured that humankind would eventually land on the moon. And that was the attitude that I took toward this, you know, because one of the fundamentals of NLP is if one person can do it, then that result can be replicated. So I think it was back in 93 when I worked with somebody whose blood sugar started to drop and become more stable that I thought, okay, you know, we've got something here, aside from my personal example. Let's see what else we can do with it. So that's where it started.
Oh, cool. And how did you, because you had your personal passion, because of your health challenges and your family's and that, that's an understandable transition to study that. That's how I got into addiction. But how did you get into the OCD, working with OCD and using that?
Yeah, OCD, or obsessive compulsive disorder, is an emotional challenge where people seemingly cannot stop thinking certain thoughts, and then in most cases cannot stop themselves apparently acting on those thoughts. And, you know, ever since I was a kid, I was highly anxiety based. And, you know, my mother even told me when I was like, I guess, 4 or something like that in New York, you know, as a kid, I used to have to line things up just right before I went to sleep or I would be upset. And then the anxieties grew, and I remember probably being around age 12 or something, I would have nuclear nightmares, is what I call them, where because of, you know, being aware of certain things going on at that time, and I'm 45 now, I would, you know, I was worried about the end of the world, as it were, and I would have nuclear nightmares where I would see a plane literally dropping a bomb, I'd see the mushroom cloud, I'd feel it sweeping over me, and I would wake up in my bed convulsing, you know, just thrashing around, the sheets were soaked in sweat, and I would just be an emotional wreck, you know, for a good part of the day. And on top of that, there were the usual, you know, anxieties that were engendered by a chaotic household as well.
Mm-hmm.
And once I became aware of what was going on and that sort of thing, and it took a while, I began to wonder how could I apply the things that I knew, you know, first about hypnosis and that sort of thing, to this kind of a problem. And so, you know, that's my particular personal story. I learned about OCD because eventually, for some reason, I just started exploring it, you know, from a personal point of view, and then realizing that there were times, Will, when I had worked with people who obviously had anxiety, deep, what I call deep anxiety challenges that caused them to have obsessive thoughts and compulsions. And so, you know, there were times when the stuff wouldn't work, the hypnosis and stuff, and I'd ask myself why. You know, what was missing? What was wrong with this? And this bears on something that I want to communicate to people. The reason that it is utterly essential to know about anxiety and OCD challenges is because these people will walk into your office, and they will have these challenges, but they'll walk in with a different problem. And unless a person is able to recognize what is termed an emotion, an anxiety disorder, which I don't particularly like that phrase, unless a person can recognize that, they can use all the tools in the world, but if they are not ecological in their approach to this person's problem, then there is a significant chance that their interventions may not work at all, or they will be temporary.
Oh, okay. Well, let me ask you a quick question. I mean, can you give a since a lot of the people on the call is hypnotists and NLPers, we don't diagnose. Of course, I'm a psychologist. I guess I could if I wanted to. But what what would be a good working definition of the anxiety and then the OCD, the obsessive compulsive disorder, that we could use as hypnotists and NLPers? And can you separate that from, you know, everybody gets a little worried and upset, you know, price of gas is $4 a gallon and, you know, and things like that. So, I mean, how can you differentiate, you know, between, you know, normal worries, fears, and anxieties and, like you say, when it becomes a problem? Because I know I've dealt with this in my practice, God, for 20 years, probably 10,000
yeah.
clients. So if you could do that.
Yeah, so first of all, you know, what you're asking is, you know, what are anxiety challenges, what is OCD, and what is just normal anxiety or worry? So let's start with the last one first. For people who do not have what is known as an emotional disorder or an anxiety disorder, first of all, let me address that. I dislike the term mental illness because it is a label, and everybody lives up or down to labels. And the thing of it is, and this speaks to an NLP technique, a version of it called reframing. If somebody comes to me and they say, I have an anxiety disorder, I have obsessive compulsive disorder, it's a mental illness, one of the first things that I do is I help them to reframe that from a disease, a disease, or some other pejorative interpretation. I reframe that into a condition. Diabetes is not a disease, for example. It is a condition. In 83, I think Dr. Julian Whitaker wrote a book called Reversing Diabetes. And in that book, he says, look, diabetes isn't a disease. It's a condition. A condition can be controlled and conceivably cured, whereas a disease is emotionally crippling to a lot of people. So that's one of the first things to do with anybody who walks in with what they think is an emotional illness. And again, I don't diagnose. And by the way, for anybody that is dealing with something that is a diagnosed or diagnosable condition, I always suggest, I tell them, look, you've got to get a medical referral for me because I cannot deal with that unless your doctor says it's okay, because otherwise I'm doing something known as practicing medicine without a license.
Right.
And I refuse to do that. So what I do is I give them a referral form, and it says I'm going to help you as a stress management consultant and a motivational coach, and I'm going to help you in regard to those two areas with what you're dealing with. Mm-hmm. And I need your doctor's okay. That being said, there are people who might think that they have an anxiety disorder or something else, but they haven't been diagnosed. And so they say, you know, I tend to worry a lot about the price of gas. It seems to be on my mind a lot. The difference is, technically, okay, when you look at the DSM-4 or other diagnostic criteria, a person whose life is affected more than 1 hour a day.
Can everyone, excuse me, let me make sure everybody, if they could hit *2 to mute your line, because we got people talking in the background. Sorry. Go ahead, Devin, sorry.
Alrighty, yeah, no problem. I didn't know if somebody was asking a question or not, or it was the voices in my head getting really loud. You know, I walked into a store one time. I had one of those little earpieces on the side that the clerk couldn't see, and the clerk was a really interesting person. He had piercings just about everywhere on his face, and a sawed-off shirt and everything else. And I was talking, and so this clerk looked at me a bit funny. And I looked at him, and I said, don't worry, it's just the voices in my head, but they like you. And this person actually backed up as far as he could away from me. it was great. This is a guy who looked like a freak, and he's looking at me, you know, Joe insurance salesman-looking guy, like I'm the freak. And that brings me to a teaching point about the whole anxiety OCD thing. When appropriate and how you can introduce humor into the whole thing. Because I have a saying, the reason that angels can fly is because they take themselves so lightly. And we are all angels in training. And we just have to learn to take ourselves a little bit more lightly. So, a normal person, quote-unquote, and I use that term very loosely, normal person who doesn't have an anxiety disorder or what I prefer to call an emotional injury, they do not allow their worries to consume a significant amount of time in their day. They think about it, they're concerned about it, but then they move on to other things. A person with OCD typically spends at least an hour a day somehow involved with their anxiety and or obsession. So that is a brief take on OCD, and I'd like to discuss what OCD is a little bit more, but for just a moment, let's talk about anxiety disorders. There are a lot of different types of anxiety emotional injuries that people suffer from, and these include panic disorder, and of course OCD. There's PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. You've got... Hello?
Yep, go ahead.
You've got generalized anxiety disorder. There's social phobia, you know, where people are just afraid to go out. There's agoraphobia, which in its real meaning is fear of the marketplace. It's fear of open places. I dealt with a client, probably back in, I think, 97. And this guy had such severe agoraphobia that 3 days prior to knowing he was going to leave the house, he started suffering from severe bowel disorders. I mean, the guy, and he hadn't worked in 3 years. But, you know, doing some phone work with him finally got him into the office and then was able to help him from there. And that's agoraphobia, where basically people are afraid to go anywhere. Then there are, of course, specific phobias or anxieties. If I see a snake, I freak out. If it's a spider or anything else. So those are general anxiety disorders. So you've got people with normal worry concerns, you know, who worry about things, they're concerned about them, but it doesn't consume their life, as it were. They're not controlled by it. Then you have people with anxieties who, for the most part, can carry on more or less the way they are, and that's, as I said, panic and social phobias, agoraphobia, specific phobias, so on and so forth. Then you have people with what I call the granddaddy or the godfather of all anxiety disorders, which is obsessive compulsive disorder. Diagnostic criteria starts at 1 hour a day for this, but anybody with real OCD, it's a lot more than an hour a day. It's pretty much, I would have to say, two-thirds to their entire day where they are focused on this in some way, shape, or form. So, you know, to address what you asked me about, Will, how normal people can deal with anxieties, they just manage to shut them off. They say, well, I'll deal with it somehow. And then there are people with anxiety disorders who have a specific thing. And by the way, generalized anxiety disorder increased in the United States after 9/11. Because, of course, everybody's sense of security was threatened. You know, and then of course, it was hyped up or amped up, you know, by unfortunate so-called news reporting and everything else. Fear is a great motivator. You want to control people, install fear in them. Then you've got OCD. Obsessive-compulsive disorder is, in a classic sense, it is defined as a person, and this is how I describe it in my book. Well, first of all, I'll give you the general description. Persistent upsetting thoughts, obsessions, and this person with these persistent upsetting thoughts then uses rituals, also known as compulsions, to control the anxiety that the thoughts produce. The problem, or the challenge, is that most of the time the rituals to end the anxiety, first of all, the solution lasts for a very short period of time, and the rituals or the solution ends up controlling the person who's suffering. And by the way, there's a couple other disorders I want to talk about that are not termed OCD because the general literature doesn't support it, but this is my experience and my research. Eating disorders are OCD. You've got attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And by the way, anybody who's interested in that, Tom Hartman, with Tom with an H, has written some good books on it, and he also has an interesting take on what ADHD is. He goes back to the hunter-gatherer model, where actually ADHD or ADD was a good thing because it was a survival tool. So other disorders or challenges that are anxiety-based but not called OCD or anxiety disorders are eating, ADD, ADHD, smoking, nail-biting, trichotillomania, and there's a lot more of that stuff. In general, OCD, as I said, is characterized, you've got insistent intrusive thoughts. This is my definition in my book. Insistent intrusive thoughts that occur with above average frequency and most importantly, they result in some sort of harm to that person. Does this make sense?
Yeah.
I mean, this is what, you know, after studying the literature and really looking at the stuff and understanding this. And OCD, you know, again, mental illness. No, it's not. There are two ways to look at OCD, and it has to be done simultaneously. Number one, it is an emotional injury, because anxiety, undue extreme anxiety, is because of an emotional injury. Number two, there are a lot of people out there with obsessive-compulsive tendencies, but they're not actually disordered in a classic sense. What I do with my clients, Will, is I help them to reframe, as I mentioned before, to help them change the way they look at it from a disease, a crippling character defect, so on and so forth. I help them change it not only into a condition that can be controlled, but into a gift. Think about Michelangelo. Let me ask you something. If somebody came up to you and said, I have a bit of OCD, I want to lay on my back for 7 years and paint the ceiling of a church. That's all I want to do. That would seem a bit obsessive compulsive, don't you think? And that's what Michelangelo did. You know, and by the way, one of the things that I help my clients to do to reframe OCD as a curse into a gift. As I say, did you know Charles Darwin had OCD? Howard Hughes? Mark Summers, Billy Bob Thornton, there's Jessica Alba, Donald Trump, he's got a fear of germs. And then there are Cameron Diaz and Leonardo DiCaprio. Go figure, I wonder if he got it from making The Aviator. Michael Jackson, of course, you know. Have you seen that movie, The Aviator?
Yeah.
he did a brilliant job. Harrison Ford, you know, he's a guy that has claimed to have OCD. Howard Stern, that's not unusual, he's a whack job anyway. Howie Mandel, you know, Beethoven, you know, and then there's Einstein. Now think about it. Here's a guy that whose mind is so preoccupied with thoughts and having to act on them that he barely passes through school, and somebody says, you know what, you're going to be a failure, you're not very bright, so on and so forth, and yet look at the contributions that Einstein has made.
Mm-hmm.
And there are so many more famous people with OCD. It is important to let your client know that there are famous, incredibly gifted people with obsessive-compulsive disorder.
Well, isn't it your buddy Kevin says a little bit of OCD and a couple other things equals success?
OCD and a couple other things equals success?
Yeah, like OCD and a little bit of, I remember reading something where he wrote that because it keeps you on task. You know?
And yeah, it does.
So how would
you know, the thing...
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's fine. You know, at that point, then you reach that fuzzy distinction. It's like, well, you know, at this point, what is OCD? And I always go back to the definition that I think, my definition, of course, you know, is that insistent intrusive thoughts occurring with above average frequency that result in a form of harm to that person. So if a person is obsessed with what they do, and overall the benefit tends to be on the plus side, then is that a problem? Or is it just an aspect of their character? Because look at the reverse of this. People who are not obsessed with doing stuff, people who are not focused on accomplishing certain things, you know, and this is what I was like for a long time. You know, I lived from minute to minute. I still had my obsessive thoughts and stuff, but they were not channeled in a way that could produce something useful for me, because in NLP, you've got useful, not useful. And so, you know, I guess in a way, if you think about it, if you can install healthy, you know, obsessive compulsiveness in somebody, they get a lot more done. I dealt with a crack addict years ago, and of course an aspect of his life is that he was highly disordered, and yes, he was obsessed with crack and everything else, and the guy ended up getting over the crack addiction, and he became a lot more organized in his life and a lot happier. So it's all about channeling this person's unbelievable power of focus in a way that it benefits them instead of not. Hmm. OCD runs in our family. I went to my brother's place one time. One room, we couldn't use it. It was a guest room. Stacked full of newspapers. That's called hoarding. And I'll go into the different types of OCD later on if we've got time.
Okay. Well, how do you... Okay, when someone first comes in, is the first thing you do, let's say for OCD, is you get them to reframe what that means and what it is?
The very first thing, well, that I do with any client is I make them happier for having seen me. Because there's something called client mortality. And I wrote about this in an article that was published in the journal. It's on my website, where I was dealing with a kidney cancer client. And a lot of people are trained classically with hypnosis, where you go straight in for the initial sensitizing events, you know, or you just dive into the problem and you try and fix it. The problem is, if it's not a comfortable first session with a client, they're less inclined to come back, you know, because it was painful. So I get somebody who comes in, and if they tell me, like this client that I'm working with right now, he drives 4 hours from a different state to see me, and he's doing a whole lot better now. He had these crazy, crazy making thoughts. They were absolutely, and he'd been in a psych center, and he'd been in terrible shape. And the very first thing I do is I want to make that person feel better for having seen me. So I might not even address the problem. I listen to them. You know, because Dale Carnegie says, you want to be a fascinating conversationalist? You know, 2 ears, one mouth. Somebody will say, oh, they were a great talker if you listen twice as much as you talk. You let the other person talk. So I let the client talk, and then where I can, I gently begin to reframe. The most common thing you're going to hear with OCD people is this. First of all, you're a portal ass call. And then they're going to say, everybody I've seen, or almost everybody I've seen, pretty much everybody they've seen, actually, tells me I just have to cope with it. And so then I begin to talk to them and say, so this doctor who's prescribed you for a variety of meds, how have they worked for you, by the way? And I'm not against medications. I'm against the overprescription of medications. And so they say, you know, well, they tell me I have to cope with it, and that's a sense of hopelessness and everything else. And then I'll just ask them, you know, I'll say, well, what if you could somehow see this condition in a different way? What if you could somehow think about it in a different way? Or maybe you don't have to just cope with it, but instead you can begin to have a better life because of this unique power of your mind. So the first thing I do is make them comfortable, let them talk, and then I just do gentle reframing. And generally, I will do a stress reduction technique. It always works. And that's the first thing I do.
Oh, okay. And give us some highlights of some other types of OCDs. Because that's for those of us that deal with general people coming in, as you said earlier. How many times does a client come in and say, well, I want to do this, but the real problem's something else?
General types of OCD.
Yeah.
First of all, we should talk about what I think needs to be known by people. Statistically, there's a little over 2 million adults who are known to have OCD, distressing symptoms of it. The thing of it is children in OCD has not been nearly as studied, but what has been studied indicates that roughly in families, about 10% of relatives, immediate relatives of people with obsessive compulsive disorder, 10% of those people, children, will have the disorder. They'll develop it. Everybody can think of a family where the children somehow mimic or exactly copy a disorder or a challenge of the parent. Now, if both parents have it, then according to statistics, there is a 20% chance, which I think is a lot higher, but, you know, stats say that there's a 20% chance that a person will develop the OCD. And, by the way, there are a lot of different tests that people can use to determine if a person's obsessive-compulsive, but, you know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out, wow, this is what this person is thinking about all the time. you know, or nearly all the time, and it's controlling their life. And by the way, OCD tends to strike men and women equally, sort of an equal opportunity condition and all of that. So one of the things is you got somebody who comes in, let's say they talk to you and they say, you know, I want to do better at work. I seem to be distracted a lot. And you look down and you notice their hands are raw. The skin is chapped severely. The hands are red. And you have to ask yourself, I wonder how their hands got that way. You would then begin a general conversational intake, and you'd say, I can definitely help you with that. You know, just distraction at work, or you want to increase your productivity. Sure, you know, NLP and hypnosis can definitely help with that. And you begin to talk to them, and you eventually find out, you know what, this person washes their hands 20 or 30 times a day. You know, they don't like to touch certain buttons, like Donald Trump. He will not touch the ground floor button. He will not shake hands with people because he's afraid of germs, especially teachers. And again, these are all things you need to know so that when somebody comes in, you know, if you go to shake their hand or something like that or they avoid it, that's an immediate clue right there. So one symptom of OCD is if a person is obsessed with germs or dirt and it leads them to develop this compulsion to wash their hands over and over again. God, I want to talk about this one client I had come in who spent 8 days here because there are times when a person could think it's OCD and it turns out to be something else like narcissistic personality disorder and that sort of thing. Or a person could be afraid of blood, you know, or anything red. Another symptom of OCD is if a person develops an obsession, say, with a lack of safety, possible home intruders, which can lead a person to locking, relocking their doors several times before going to bed. One of my big deals, and one that is actually pretty common with clients, because I've got another client right now who has to go back to her house. She pulls out, and after she's sure she hasn't run somebody over just backing out of her driveway, and it sounds funny, but it's very real, she then has to pull back into the driveway and go in and check all the plugs and all the appliances and unplug stuff. Again, it's a security thing. There are people who check their alarm clocks or just check their clocks, you know, 4, 5, 6 times. A lot of OCD sufferers are afraid of social embarrassment. A symptom of this is, and think teenagers here, somebody who stands in front of a mirror for an unbelievably long time, combing their hair to get it just right. This right. is a hypnotic ritual that actually traps somebody in a mirror. You know, and they can't move away from it. And of course, there's, you know, the picking of zits as well, which, you know, is very common. A little bit, of course, is normal, but there are a lot of people who just spend an unbelievably long time in front of the mirror. The point here is this, you know, is that for the people who engage in these rituals, they are not fun or enjoyable. I knew a person back in Florida who had to vacuum their way out of their house so the nap of the carpet faced the exact way that made them feel better.
Right. Well, you bring up a good point because, you know, a lot of us have little quirks in our personality, and sometimes clients will show up, you know, I'd call it a personality quirk. But to me, and I get your opinion on it, you know, when I'm gathering the information, like you said, let the client talk, you know, at least twice as much as I do. My first hypnotic mentor always told me, you know, they're not paying. The problem with hypnotists is they fall in love with their own voice and
yeah.
and gather information. But you mentioned the perfect example with the person that the carpet had to be a certain way. I always went by the rule of thumb, and I even learned this in one of my internships for psychology, is, you know, if it becomes kind of like an addiction, if it becomes life, not just, it may not be life-threatening, but it interferes with daily living, then it crosses the line into something a little bit more than a normal personality quirk, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, like, yeah, I mean, it's a good thing to wash your hands. I should probably wash my hands more, but I'm not a germaphobe. But, you know,
exactly.
If I never washed my hands, then that could be a problem. So, you know, that's just a rule of thumb for those of us that deal with this. But I'd like to ask you a question about You said, like, let's bounce back to diabetes, then we'll come back to OCD, if that's okay.
Sure.
Because I know in my case, and I never specialized in it, and I always call people up when I have a technical question. Like, I just worked with a couple people for irritable bowel, and that's not my expertise, so I called a couple people I know, got their feedback on what to do with them. But I know when I had my weight loss clinic, and as you know, I had a huge clinic cooking in Indiana for a while and down here in Florida, I would say, I'd get 15 to 20% of my weight loss clients were either diabetic or borderline diabetic or hypo or hyperglycemic, so they were having the blood sugar issues. So I was very careful, you know, not to cross into medical thing. But how was your success, like you said, when you got people to alter their behavior so they changed their, you know, what they eat, when they eat, how they eat, and was that helpful with their diabetes and hyperglycemia?
There's 3 points I want to bring up. First of all, the latest statistics that just came out.
About diabetes. Yeah, bring that up.
Yeah. 24 million Americans are diagnosed. This is up 3 million from last year. Another 57 million.
That's because we're a sweet country.
Oh, we are so sweet. Yeah. And obsessed, you know, with the lifestyle, and more especially the food that encourages that sort of thing, never mind the stress. And you know, were there time, I would talk about, you know, this one equation that totally spells it out, but it's in my book about control your diabetes with hypnosis. The thing of it is there is roughly 24 million diagnosed and another 57 million people who are pre-diabetic.
Now, let me interrupt you real quick, because many people don't understand pre-diabetic and those terms like hypo and hyperglycemia. So if you could talk about that would be, I would like that, the pre-diabetes and the hyper.
Yeah, I wrote an article, by the way. Speaking of, first of all...
Well, give us your website if it's going to be on... Yeah, it'd be great.
I have a ton of articles on my website, mindbodyhypnosis.com, about diabetes, especially, you know, where people can go and get a lot of information about it. Or they can search through, if they get the National Guild of Hypnotists Journal, I've got a lot of articles there. Hypoglycemia means low blood sugar, and that used to be what is known as a fad disease. And what it means is that a person's pancreas is what I call a type A pancreas that produces too much insulin. And so their blood sugars drop, and then they have to eat something. They are literally physiologically compelled to eat something to bring up their blood sugars. And what is most handy, what is most often consume high carbohydrates. I did a radio show on this years ago. I was on WINZ down in Florida. Was it INZ or another radio station? Anyway, and I talked about this because one of the things about carbohydrates, speaking of addictions, is that they become addictive because there is a serotonin cycle. You eat carbs, you produce more serotonin, you feel good. The problem with hypoglycemia is that a person's pancreas tends to produce more insulin than is necessary, and a person suffers from a low blood sugar. So what happens is they begin to get irritable and everything else, and the syllogism is, I feel terrible. If I eat, I feel better.
Mm-hmm.
Hyperglycemia is when a person has too much blood sugar. And again, this is where they have begun in most cases, and this is what people don't know about diabetes. Most diabetics produce too much insulin initially and for quite some period of time. A lot of it, there are stupid scripts out there. There's one called Turning on the Insulin Valve. You know, and this is why people must be educated about this stuff. If you get somebody who comes in and says, hey, I got diabetes and this and that, and you say, okay, let's turn on the insulin valve, a person can, and most likely, worsen the condition. It is not a problem with too much sugar. It is a problem with insulin resistance that creates the hyperglycemia, too much blood sugar. The body has become resistant to normal levels of insulin. Does this make sense so far?
Yeah, great.
A ton of information to throw at somebody. So you get an obese person coming in to see you. The chances are that they have what would be termed an endocrine disorder, an endocrine system disorder, because the endocrine system is involved completely in the whole diabetes thing. The chances are very high, because stress will ultimately lead to insulin resistance. So if you see somebody who is grossly obese, first of all, be certain that they have emotional issues that must be resolved. Secondly, there is a good chance they have insulin resistance. If they are not diagnosed as pre-diabetic, which means having blood sugars that are not quite diabetic, but they're leading that way, then they have a balance issue. The body is not responding to what should be normal amounts of insulin. If I see somebody who's obese, I ask them, I tell them, I can't work with you until you have a full physical. Because if they have diabetes and it's not diagnosed, and I am treating them for something, they have to go in and get the workup because they've got to deal with it. If somebody is diagnosed and they're on medications, because a very common medication for hyperglycemia, too much blood sugar, is glucophage. And funny enough, women with polycystic ovary syndrome, you know, where they get like, you know, growths on their ovaries and stuff, they can have high blood sugars. The point here is this, and this is what people have to know. If you're working with somebody who's got blood sugar balance issues, and if they're taking medications, you have to make sure that they monitor their blood sugars, because as they are getting rid of the weight, their blood sugars could begin to swing and there could be problems. Not always, but it's a possibility. In theory and in practice, and I've watched this with clients, as they get rid of the weight, their medication needs are decreasing, and they have to be aware of this. They have to work in conjunction with their doctor to alter their medication levels as need be. I could go on and on about this, but I want to keep it as concise as possible. Is this so far making sense?
Oh, yeah. And do you have I understand you, like you say, you have some books and some training programs on how we hypnotists and NLPers can work with diabetics.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've got a video.
So tell us your website again over the...
Well, thanks. I do appreciate the plug, and that really is nice, you know, because in anything that I am able to share with other people in exchange for their green energy helps me to buy diapers for my 2-year-old son. And also, I didn't tell you this, but we got a baby in the oven.
Oh.
There's going to be another one running
that
around.
You know that.
Yeah, Rachel's pregnant. So, and the thought that really disturbs me is it's going to be at least 7 years that I will be changing diapers every day. It's like, no, not diapers. Oh, God.
Well, you make me feel bad. My baby's 28, so.
Yeah, I'm an old goat. I started late, I got to admit it.
Yeah,
for anybody that's interested in this stuff, let me tell you, feel free to call or email me. Really busy. Happy to offer whatever advice I can at no charge by phone or email. Please be patient, be persistent. Sometimes emails go into the spam bin and it takes me a while to actually get to it. If a person is interested in training about this stuff, and honest to goodness, you know, with diabetes and OCD, a person really, really needs to know about this stuff. And by the way, Will, and I'll talk about this later, I do have a special for people who are interested in, being able to use hypnosis, especially for obsessive-compulsive disorder. But the website is mindbodyhypnosis.com. And it's important information. People need to know it. But you can get on the web and research it. Whatever you do, make sure it's good information and make sure you know it. Because
Go ahead.
Just a brief statement. One of the things that contributes to client mortality, somebody not coming back to see you, is if they feel you're not competent or knowledgeable about their condition.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And I'll give a testimonial that you are available to ask questions. I remember a few years ago, you may not remember it, but I remember calling and asking you some questions about diabetics when my mother-in-law was diagnosed and wanted me to make her a CD. And I remember talking to you about that.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
And
yeah, actually,
you,
I did forget
you,
about
you shared information freely with me. So.
Yeah, gotta have the abundance mentality. You know, there's enough people for all of us to help out there. There really is. Okay.
And with this rampant, literally explosion epidemic of diabetes, and all you have to do is walk around and look at the kids today to see the next onslaught. I mean, juvenile diabetes, I know, is going through the roof.
Well, and that brings an interesting point. And by the way,
please,
for those anybody listening, if you want more OCD information, I don't know how much time we have. I'm willing to just keep chatting for anybody
who's keep going.
Listening. But it used to be that there were four types of diabetes. Type 1, which is juvenile diabetes, generally diagnosed before a person turned 20. Okay? It used to be classified, by a failure of the beta cells located in the pancreas, a failure of the beta cells to produce sufficient amounts of insulin, also known as normal amounts. That was type 1. The best way to think about this, folks, is type 1 diabetes, think of the number 1 and picture a needle. Type 1 diabetics have to take shots. It's called exogenous introduction of insulin. It's from an outside source. Endogenous insulin was where it was produced by the body. And so type 1 diabetics didn't have enough, or they had none at all. Obviously I'm an info geek because I get excited, like, talking about how this could happen and stuff. Then there's type 2 diabetes, which used to be classified as over 40 overweight. And that was type 2. Then there was type 1.5, very rare, roughly 2% of the diabetic population. That's what I am. Type 2 diabetes is where a person did not get type 1, but they're not overweight and they're not 40. I was diagnosed when I was 30. I was skinny, not too skinny, because people with undiagnosed diabetes are rail thin. Diabetes was known as the malnutrition disease because people could eat all they wanted and they would die because their body would never be able to get the nutrition. So you get type 1 needles, type 2 pills, over 40 overweight. Type 1.5 happens in people under 40 underweight. And then there's gestational diabetes. With this understanding in mind, kids are now getting type 2 diabetes because they are massively overweight and under-exercised. And also, kids are dealing with stressors that no child should ever have to deal with. Will, I think it's a problem. I think it's an epidemic that kids no longer can have a childhood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this is leading to all kinds of emotional challenges for these people. Then you've got something called mixed diabetes, where a kid has type 1 in the sense that they have to take shots, and type 2. And then there's something called diabulimia. This is where girls are using their diabetes to remain stick thin. If they think they've gained an extra half ounce, they avoid taking their medications because they know that diabetes will literally melt the weight off of them. So, yes, it is a freaking epidemic. You know, and there's lots of room for people to help them.
Oh, okay. Well, you're a living example of using a personal passion, you know, that with the diabetes and the OCD, because, you know, self, family, and just a personal passion, and turning it into an expertise and or a niche market. You know, and that's kind of what I did with the addictions and my sports. So.
I love reading your e-zines, you know, when you talk about tournaments you've been to and stuff like that, because I love martial arts anyway.
Yeah, I'm limping around today. I hyperextended my knee. I have to keep reminding myself the body's 52, even though the mind thinks I'm 22.
Yeah. It's like, be aware. What did Clint Eastwood say? Man's got to know his limits.
Yeah. Well, I've been doing kickboxing, and they do full contact, so that's a new challenge.
Godfrey. Holy cow. Yeah, no thanks. I had an eye socket cracked one time where I was spitting blood and couldn't see out of an eye for a weekend. Yeah, that was...
Well,
that was an...
You've got babies. I'm done, so I can hurt myself.
Yeah, exactly. Stay off of trampolines, whatever you do.
Yeah. Oh, we have one. We have a competition trampoline.
That's right.
Don't forget, my wife's a trapeze artist. So.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, let me ask you another quick question about to tie it back into like the OCD. Have you ever seen? Because I've done this. Or I've seen this with clients. They have a health issue, much like, let's say, a diabetic issue or a hypohyperglycemia issue. And because they have OCD, or at least some variation of that, that becomes what they obsess on.
Their health issue?
Yes.
You know
and
what?
And they can never get past it because they're always stuck in it. Have you...
There are two things. I'm working on a third book called 21st Century Medicine, The Proven Healing Power of the Mind. And I presented this workshop over in England last year. One of the things I talked about was a phenomenon that is well known called resistance to healing, where people don't want to get together with themselves. They don't want to get better. Carolyn Mace, M-Y-S-S, has summed it up really nicely in something that is known as woundology. People speak the language of woundology, you know, where that's their identity. So they can bond with other people in their survivors group and their recovery group or whatever, even though these groups actually don't allow people to ultimately get together because get better, because if you get better, you're out of the group, you know, in a lot of ways.
Right.
People find social connection, and there are all kinds of important secondary gain benefits to hanging on to a problem. And this is something I address in my book, by the way, on anxiety, OCD, and hypnosis. There's a chapter titled, Who Am I If I'm Not OCD? Who am I if I don't have this medical problem? People don't know. There's a vacuum. Nature abhors a vacuum. So these people hang on to their wounds because it's a sense of identity and all that sort of stuff, you know, where they can, then they have something to talk about, there's something meaningful in their lives, so on and so forth. Something else that's important about this is that being a victim means you don't have personal responsibility to take charge of your life. It's, you know, the old saying, it's far easier to find a good scapegoat than a good solution.
Yeah.
You know, it's true. I always wanted to run a Yellow Page ad under S for scapegoat. Blame me for any occasion. Bad day, $50. Divorce, $500. You know, give me a call, it's my fault. You know, so people bond to their wounds. They don't want to let go of them. They obsess on them because it gives them meaning. And also, you know, people who have these things and... This is a book, everybody who's listening, write this title down, The Divided Mind. This book will blow your world into wonderful pieces. It's by John Sarno, John with an H, M.D. And in the book, he talks about how people manifest all kinds of challenges, from arthritis pains to psoriasis. And it deals with unresolved, unaddressed emotions. He calls it the well of rage, which is not probably the best term to describe it. But it's emotions that simply aren't working or being addressed. So people cling, and the reason that they have these symptoms, everything from arthritis difficulties to chronic neck pain to back pain that is not resolved, by the way, through surgeries that actually, for the most part, aren't proven to work. Spinal fusion is one. 2.3 million or billion dollars a year is spent on the hardware and the surgeries for spinal fusion, but there is not a shred of good evidence that proves it works for the majority of people who go through it. The reason that these people have these issues is because these real pain problems are distracting them from what is going on inside their heart. People who cling to these things, I'm working with a client now, bulimic, you know, who's been through the whole gamut of therapy, you know, done it all. Is it working? No. 10 years later, stick thin, exhausted, emotionally crushed, and everything else. None of the stuff has worked. You can bet your bottom dollar that this person has unaddressed emotional issues that must be resolved in some way, shape, or form. And, Will, that's why people cling to these problems.
Mm-hmm. And
that answers the question?
Yeah, and hypnosis and NLP is a great modality to help.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. And by the way, speaking of NLP, let me tell you something. An NLP technique for everybody that's listening on how to help an OCD person, and this addresses something you brought up earlier, a non-OCD person, a person so-called normal, a person who is not consumed with worry. By the way, here's a quote, folks, that's in my book. Worry is misuse of the imagination.
Oh, okay.
I like that. Because it opens so many doors. Well, how can I use my imagination? Here's the deal. A non-OCD person, a person who is not obsessed with their health or with germs or with blood or with sexual thoughts, because there are many other versions of OCD, you know, thoughts of harming somebody, thoughts of harming yourself, you know, all that stuff. Here's the deal. A person who is quote-unquote normal, they have, listen closely, a convincer strategy that works. A convincer strategy is a reality filter that a person uses to determine if something is real, okay, or good. Another way of stating this is that a convincer strategy is, it's how a person uses their inner representational systems, VACOG, to construct and maintain a belief. So a person who thinks, oh, you know, did I leave the iron on? And then they have a convincer strategy that says, no, you unplugged it, you left it standing up, everything is fine. For the OCD person, their convincer strategy is reversed in the sense that their fears inspire a stronger inner convincer strategy. Their fears inspire a stronger inner convincer strategy rather than their external reality convincer strategy.
Oh,
so what you
okay.
want to do with an OCD, does that make sense?
Yes.
Cool. I'm reminded of a story, Richard Bandler, who was talking to somebody about something, who was very certain, this person was very certain, and Bandler says, think of something you feel is absolutely certain. The person goes, okay. Bandler says, are you sure? And this person goes, yes, absolutely. Are you sure you're sure? Yes. Are you sure enough to be unsure? And the person says yes. And then Bandler says, okay, let's talk. And the point here is this, and if you're listening, write this down. Doubt your doubts. If you can get somebody to begin to doubt their doubts, they can begin to doubt their inner fear convincer strategy. So far, so good. Is this useful?
Oh, yeah, that's good.
Okay.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Let me open this up and then ask if anybody has any questions, and then we'll do a couple more things. Okay, if anyone has a question, you can unmute your line by hitting *3, and if anyone would like to ask a question.
I'm Dr. Fraser Crane. I'm listening.
Well, then,
like
Dr.
That.
Crane, why don't you come around? I have a...
Go ahead.
I have a particular case I'd be interested on, and it combines a number of these items. I deal with young gymnast children. There's a particular girl who has three things that you might talk about. What I normally work with is gymnasts who become afraid of skills they've done literally for years, round off back handspring, back tumbling, and done it for years, and then all of a sudden they have a fear of doing even the low level. This particular girl has that. In addition to that, She also has facial tics. She exhibits like eye blinking, excessive eye blinking, shoulder twitching. And of course, she also then has anxiety about competitions. Particularly in practice, one of the things that's becoming more and more prevalent is she is embarrassed because the other gymnasts, begun to notice her, her actions. But also that, say, before she does a skill on beam, she'll stand there and adjust her leotard and wipe her pants and just make, a whole series of rituals, I call them. So what advice might you have specifically? You've given some, general strategies, but what can you help me with specifically, for a girl who's in this situation and, she has time deadlines because she has competitions coming up and is going to want to deal with these things if possible.
What was your first name?
John.
I missed it. Tom?
John.
Oh, John, with an H?
John.
Okay. Ah,
yeah.
All right. What I want to do is condense a lot of information into a concise form. First of all, John, I worked with a young gymnast years ago, and simple hypnosis session helped her to get over. And it was the same thing. She was afraid of known skills. She suddenly could not do a backflip. What I did with her was I just brought her back, regressed her to those times when she was able to easily do those things. Here's a challenge. It can work, but you might want to find out why it suddenly happened. Now, the difference between hypnosis and NLP is that NLP is concerned with the how. How are you becoming afraid of these things? Hypnosis is more concerned with the content. Why? What happened? My first thought would be, let's just do the straight line. Shortest distance between two points is the straight line. Get her into a state where you can anchor her. John, do you practice hypnosis or just NLP?
No, I do. I'm primarily hypnosis, and I'm very new to NLP. Maybe 10 or a dozen books is all.
Okay. So
not even any seminars. I'm coming up looking for to do one with Will, actually.
Well, by all means, I would strongly suggest it. And make sure that Will makes you put your hand in the wolf trap. Yeah, my finger is still healing, Will. by the way, I used that for a long time after that. I still have my wolf trap. That was just beautiful. All right, John, you're primarily a hypnotist. Regress her back to those times and have her relive those times when she was able to easily perform those things that are known skills to her. Does that make sense?
Sure. Yeah, that's what I normally
okay.
do.
If that works, great. The next thing that I would be curious about, because she's got facial tics, the eye blinking, the shoulder twitch, the ritual, of adjusting various things, that is a way for her to synchronize with herself or go into trance, as it were, before she performs a routine. What you can do is you can help her to create a post-hypnotic suggestion where she gets to that state of concentration much quicker. You can just say, what's her first name?
Mackenzie,
okay.
She actually has the twitches, almost constantly, not just in a gymnastic situation, but in school and even at home.
So this is basically Tourette's.
Yeah.
And here's where I run into something that is a can of worms. Let me tell you a story. Back in, I think it was the 1600s, 1700s, Mesmer, a very famous case, Franz Anton Mesmer, who created animal magnetism and all that stuff, worked with a pianist, a famous young pianist. She was about 16. And she was blind, but she was phenomenally good. He cured her of her blindness, literally. She could see. The problem was that her piano skills began to deteriorate and her interest. She was exposed to a whole new world. She wanted to do other things. The parents got really, really upset. They fired Mesmer. They said terrible things about him. And they berated the girl to the point where she went blind again. And her skills then improved. This could be a thing where you might need to work with more than the family. How old is she, John? What's her age? She's nine. This is an unfortunate thing where, you know, Wayne Dyer once said, you know, a person says, well, if my brother was just a better person, then I'd be happy. And Wayne says, fine, let me fix them in another room, and you become miraculously happy. The point to this is that you can work with her, and there are things you can do to help her become more insulated from the adverse effects of the family. What I suspect, but may be incorrect about, because that's always possible, is that there is a lot of family influence for performance and everything else. Remember, a while ago I said the problem is kids don't even have a chance to be a kid anymore. Think about the stress that a kid is under to perform for the parents, to do stuff they may not even want to do. And they will always find a way to eventually get out of doing something that they really don't want to do. I mean, the kid could be fantastic at gymnastics, but simply not want to do it. I had a kid with aphonia. She couldn't talk, except around her parents and one grandparent. I worked with her, and on the surface, it appeared to be a failure. She never spoke, normally. But she did tell me through certain processes, she indicated, she didn't say it, she indicated that by the time she was 16, which is when a kid can leave home, that she would be able to talk. So my concern, John, is that the tics and the blinking and the twitches and the anxiety and all that stuff, it could be tied to something more than just her having a defective character. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Yeah. You know, I would need to do a complete intake on this. So here's my suggestion to you. Since you're primarily a hypnotist, are you familiar with the Heartland Ego Strengthening script?
Yeah.
Use it. Read it to her. It is a great script. I am not a fan of scripts, but this one has seriously miraculous powers. I've seen it demonstrated too many times to too many people. I would do what you already have thought about, regress her to times when she was successful. If it doesn't work, by the way, that's not failure. It's called feedback. Something else needs to be addressed.
Actually, that works with her. You know, that works with her really well. Mm-hmm. But it wears off. You know, if I do two sessions with her, it'll last for a couple weeks, and then it mm-hmm. wears off. But we haven't done anything yet to affect. I don't have a copy of that script. Where would be a good place to get that? Track that down.
You could do the Hammond, Hammond, Encyclopedia of, I think it's called Metaphors and Suggestions. Better yet, just Google it. Heartland, 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 Ego Script. I believe you'll be able to find it on the web.
Okay.
Cool.
And then you might want to give suggestions that her unconscious is beginning to resolve. The issues about the eye blinking and shoulder twitch, it sounds like something where, you know, there's a lot more than meets the eye. Do you think the same thing, John?
Yeah, but I don't know what it is because...
All right, who's going to the bathroom? I just heard
That'll
a toilet.
It's
not me. There's another child in the family, though, who is... Literally the most laid back, a younger daughter, about a year and a half younger, and she's like laid back and, you know, no evidence of parental pressure at all. I only know the mother relatively well. I've met the father three times, but I don't really know that much about him. So it's...
You know, then what I would do is just explore, and here's what I would suggest. Have the little girl pretend she's the facial tic. Have her pretend she's the blinking eyes. And just tell her, I want you to think about a cartoon or a movie where you saw somebody change into something else, and I want you to change into the facial tic, and tell me what you're thinking, and you got to talk like a kid. You know, if the facial tic could actually talk, what is it saying?
Cool. All right.
Is that helping?
Good.
It does. And how quick does your book get delivered? I'm actually sitting here looking at it with it in, you know.
Well, thank you.
Ready to buy it, but you know, I'm wondering how long she has a national championship meet coming up and tumbling in like 2 weeks. You know, and she's
2 weeks.
Yeah.
For me to give you the, you can either order it straight away from Lulu at their price. They'll probably have it to you within a week. I've just sold out of all my copies, and I can get more of them and offer them to you at a discount. You know, and the other thing is, I suppose you've tried direct suggestion that the facial tics are calming down, and the eye blinking, and the ritual beforehand. John, here's what you do. Not sure how to anchor this. Bring her to a calm place. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Bring her to a calm place. Have her imagine a color. And imagine that when she brings her thumb and finger together, that color represents the state of readiness she is in after she does her ritual. In other words, you are substituting the thumb and finger for the ritual. Is that clear?
Yeah.
Okay. So she can avoid doing the ritual. She can bring her thumb and finger together and make sure, and this is Milton Erickson, make sure calming, reassuring.
Cool. Okay. Good job. Does anyone else have any questions?
Everybody else fell asleep.
No more questions. Well, Devin, why don't you give us a closing statement on the need to really delve into the working with people with OCD and, of course, the diabetes and health challenges? And again, where can they contact you? Your website, email, and, of course, your phone number. So go ahead.
I've got a phone number, 877-6-HEAL, 877-643-2537. That's the 800 number. If you want my personal cell phone, I'll give you that as well.
No.
Say what? Area code 612-730-2790.
Okay.
All you have to do is just Google Devin, or just go to Devin Hastings with an I, devin.com, and that's my speaker website, and all my other websites are located there. My main website for hypnosis and that sort of thing is mindbodyhypnosis.com. And I do have a special for anybody who's interested, two CD set, Hypnosis Solutions for Anxiety, normally sells for $50, and I got the book that normally sells for $30. You can get them both for $43.95 plus the $6 priority mail and shipping and handling and stuff like that. Remember, it's free to get in touch with me by email or phone. I'll do my best to address your questions. And when you work with people with anxiety disorders, you know, always do your best to try to first ameliorate the issue simply with direct suggestion and calming suggestions. Always be aware that there could be an exacerbating factor in there somewhere, you know, that is causing it. A book that I recommend to people is by M. Scott Peck. It's a pretty old book, but it can help shed light on extremely difficult circumstances. It's called People of the Lie. And because families oftentimes can appear normal on the surface, and under the surface there is a lot of information available. One of the stories in his book is about a kid who was a wonderful student who suddenly turned into a truant and actually drove the family car through the window of a pharmacy in order to steal drugs. The kid was 14 or 15. And Peck was called to consult with the kid, and the family was upstanding and all that other stuff. And Peck found out that the kid, the previous Christmas, probably 6 or 7 months prior to when he was called in, the kid had been given a gift by the parents. They'd given him a gun. Not a bad thing, especially, depending on your neighborhood and geography and all that. Not a bad gift. And Peck said, well, tell me about the gun. And the kid looks at him and says, it's the gun that my brother used to kill himself with.
Hmm.
And the parents had given it to him. And yet on the surface, these were PTA-perfect parents. You understand what I'm saying? So when you're dealing with kids or people who are, kids inside an adult body, you've got to look for stuff like that, because those are things that can block healing efforts. So when you deal with OCD and anxiety and stuff like that, always look for what could be causing the anxiety and seek to ameliorate that. With the diabetes, the first thing I always suggest is stress reduction. And there's a lot of evidence supporting that, including Dr. Richard Sherwood from Duke University. Hypnotized 108, he didn't hypnotize them, he just took 108 type 2 diabetics, and with nothing more than 3 20-minute relaxation sessions a week, these people dropped their blood sugars, their long-term blood sugars, as much as if they had taken certain anti-diabetic drugs. And in closing, I'd just like to say, learn as much as you can about this stuff, and I'm always willing to be an advisor for you in any way I can. And
cool.
Thanks so much for listening. I really appreciate it.
And I'd like to thank everyone for listening, and of course I'd like to thank my friend Devin for sharing with us and sharing his expertise. As he said, with the current news out there about the epidemic of diabetes and the growing problems, literally growing problems we see everywhere, especially with our children, and him as a new father and a soon-to-be new father again, we need to do this because that's something we can do. And it's always good to see students that, take a passion, turn it into helping people, and grow with that. So it's been a joy. So I'd like to thank everybody for joining us this evening, and we'll have this up on the website, and I'll get Devin the thing, so it'll be on his website if people want to listen to it again, or, of course, feel free to call Devin or myself if you have any questions. So I'd like to thank everyone.
And can I just share one final quote, Will?
Sure.
Yeah, it's something that I put in all of my emails, and I suggest that people suggest this to their clients. Speak well to yourself because your deep mind is always listening.
That's good.
Yeah.
All right. And as another great quote to close with, and I'll let it this out, is one of my idols, Cartman on South Park says, "Screw you guys, I'm going home." I always wanted
Thanks
to end
so
the training
much,
that way, and one day I will.
Yeah, Cartman, he's a riot.
So again, I'd like to thank everyone, and keep in touch and tell other people about these. We got some calls next week. On July 1st, we have Laura Boynton King. She'll talk about niche marketing, how she took a passion working with horse riders. I can never pronounce it. My wife's into that now.
Laura, she's great.
Yeah, she's going to be talking
Very
about
confident.
That, and she's built a hell of an internet
yeah.
business. And then, of course, July 2nd, a little bit earlier, 7:30, because he has a call later, Elsa Meldridge is coming on about how to network and build a business through networking. So we're getting different callers and having more fun, and other people on the horizon, Jerry Kine, Kevin Hogan, Tom Nicoli, Cal Banyan. You're going to get quite a few people on here. So
Fantastic.
Feel free to tell people about us. So I'd like to thank everyone, and have a great evening.
Good night, y'all. Thank you. And thank you,
Good
Will.
Night.
Much appreciated.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye.